State Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. The court calls United States v. Solomon. Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Ryan Matina, and I represent the appellant, Private First Class Alan Solomon. This court should set aside PFC Solomon's convictions and sentence for two reasons. First, the military judge allowed impermissible 413 evidence of prior alleged sexual assaults, but PFC Solomon was acquitted of those allegations at a prior court-martial, likely because of the strong alibi evidence. And the military judge's findings and conclusions were clearly erroneous as they don't reconcile this alibi evidence. And second, during both his closing and rebuttal argument, the trial counsel interjected his personal opinions and beliefs, made discouraging comments about the appellant's case theory and the appellant's defense counsel, and made the trial a popularity contest with the defense counsel. First, this court should give no deference to the military judge's findings in the...
Could I just one technical matter? Are you reserving time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
So granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should grant no deference to the military judge's 413 ruling here. Although not noted in the briefs, I'd like to draw the court's attention to Joint Appendix page 95, where the military judge says that there are three acts at issue here, when in actuality there are four acts: that the sexual assault with Lance Corporal B, sexual assault with Lance Corporal R, the quote-unquote Peeping Tom incident, and the fourth, the unknown figure incident. But more importantly, the military judge says that the incidents occurred in 1992, 1995, and 2001. But in actuality, these incidents at issue here occurred in 2009 and 2010. PFC Solomon was 3 years old in 1992.
Did the military judge err because he failed to address the MP report and the alibi, or is it your view that there was inherent error here that he should have ruled the other way?
Runner, certainly there was error because...
Do you understand what I'm saying? Is this a question where he just didn't provide the correct analysis on the record? Or that with this record, there is no way you can pass the 413 test?
Your Honor, given that, well, I'd say both, but given this record, there's no way you'd be able to pass the 413 test. Looking
at
that,
are you arguing for a per se rule? Basically, if there's an acquittal, it can't come in under 413?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily just because of an acquittal. Here, this court could certainly narrowly tailor a decision, given the fact that there was an acquittal, but also that there was this important alibi evidence in this case, which the military judge makes...
You believe that's your strongest argument? The alibi versus the acquittal versus similarities. That's how you presented it.
Well, yes, Your Honor. The fact that there was the two in conjunction, that there was an acquittal and that it was an acquittal based on the alibi evidence. In addition to also the 403 analysis, there are errors there as well.
Counsel, other than the omissions that the military judge made in his findings and conclusions, particularly about the defense evidence as to the prior acts, what specifically do you find clearly erroneous as to the military judge's findings?
Well, Your Honor, the finding that PFC Solomon got into his car after the alleged assaults against Lance Corporal D and R and then drove away, there's no evidence of that at all in the record that he had formed.
Do you think it's possible for him to have concluded that that's what happened from the evidence, to have extrapolated from the evidence as to that's what he believed happened?
Well, it's certainly, Your Honor, what the lower court did in their opinion. However, they in essence made up those two facts, which are not supported by the record, and actually they're contradicted by the record.
How are they contradicted by the record?
Your Honor, the fact that Lance Corporal B and R in their sworn statements said that the alleged assault occurred around 0230 to 0300 that morning, then later on at the first court-martial testified that it happened at 0200, and specifically Lance Corporal B testified that she saw the two on the clock as to the hour, it was the 0200 hour. And then third, testified it for a third time at Private First Class Solomon's trial that it was a 0200 hour. The fact that they said that, given the police report saying that PFC Solomon was detained from 0158 for about an hour and a half by military police 45 minutes away from the location.
Now, I understand all of that, counsel, but the military judges appears to have believed that they got the time wrong or that this all happened later.
Right. Yes, Your Honor, and that's...
And all I'm saying is, I understand that that's not the conclusion that you would draw, but how is he clearly erroneous to have drawn that conclusion?
Well, it's clearly erroneous, Your Honor, because of the Lance Corporal's consistent testimony of when this assault occurred, given the fact that the military police are saying that during this time period, he was wholly unable to because he was 45 minutes...
What about their consistent testimony that they saw him and they identified him? Their statements both indicated that they knew who it was in their room at that time.
Yes, Your Honor, they said...
Why could not the military judge look at that and say, well, on the one hand, we have this police report that says he's at the gate at 0158, and on the other hand, we have these two Lance Corporals who both said they worked with the fellow every day, and they know who it was. How do you address that?
Your Honor, the military judge here, by basically not addressing and reconciling this issue, that is reasonable alone to not give this particular military judge any deference here. The fact that he was detained for an hour and a half and was at the time detained for a DUI where he blew a .20 and a .19 blood alcohol content also shows that the statements by Lance Corporal B and Lance Corporal R here are not factually accurate.
Counsel, just what is in evidence before this court as to the prior acts? At the Article 39A hearing, both sides put in attachments to their brief. One was the letter from the prior defense counsel. The other was the incident report. Then the government put in the two statements. Are we to consider all of those as being in evidence as the case has proceeded up the appellate line?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, in terms of what the military judge had to make his decision, and there was not much evidence put out at all. Of course, it's the government's burden there at trial to show that the second right prong was met, and here it wasn't.
So do you believe that the email from the prior counsel was properly in evidence at that hearing and is before this court properly?
Yes, Your Honor, as attached to the defense's motion, yes.
Counsel, you began your argument by referring to page 95 of the joint appendix and three dates in that, 1992, 1995, and 2001. My recollection is you say you did not mention that in your brief.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And was that mentioned in the brief at the court below, the erroneous dates?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
And was it mentioned at trial? Did the defense counsel at trial or in any post-trial motion object to the use of those dates?
No, Your Honor. So
if no one thought that in all those prior proceedings, including the briefs before those court, attached any significance to those dates, why should this court do anything other than treat them as typographical errors?
Because, Your Honor, when you look at these findings, they were done 2.5 months after the military judge made his determination in this case. On the record, he gave a cursory indication of what he was going to do with the MRE 413 motion, gave little to no actual analysis, parroted back the standard, and then said he was going to supply the actual findings later. He appended that to the end of the record 2.5 months later. So this wasn't something that was done or should have been done gingerly. He had 2.5 months to write on the most important issue here in this case because the propensity evidence was critical here.
I understand that. How does the use of those dates demonstrate that any aspect of the judge's findings were clearly erroneous as a matter of law with respect to those findings that are critical to the case before us? Is it anything other than just indicating carelessness in his typing?
Your Honor, the court can't be positive that the military judge was evaluating the correct facts in this case or if he was using facts from another case and made the mistake in his analysis. The fact that there isn't much analysis throughout his decision should also give this court great pause.
So is that your strongest argument, that he got the dates wrong in his written materials?
No, Your Honor, that's just one example. There are many examples of why the military judge...
Well, can you see why we think it's not a very good example? It somewhat weakens the force of your other arguments?
What,
that you're grasping at that?
Your Honor, I understand that may be the court's position, but the other incidents where the military judge doesn't make any findings of fact of the time, which is the critical issue here, the fact the military judge never mentions that PFC Solomon was detained for an hour and a half during the same time that the Lance Corporals claimed that he was in their room, the fact that the military judge's also, his use of standards of review are as haphazard as his findings of fact here as well. If you look at his Article 39A notice of his decision, there's no analysis done of the 403 analysis, and he uses the wrong 403 standard. And he parrots that as well. He uses the wrong 403 standard on page 97 of the Joint Appendix as well. So all these reasons should give this court pause to find that the military judge should have any deference here in this case. And the prejudice here is substantial, given this 413 evidence. This was not evidence that was just tacked on to the government's case. The trial counsel made it the centerpiece of their case and wove the three assaults together.
And the trial counsel may have made it the centerpiece, but it doesn't appear that the defense counsel did. You know, you got some pretty substantial stuff here. You got an acquittal, you've got an alibi, and he didn't really drive it home, did he? Well, he just kind of nibbled around the edges.
And that's a problem, Your Honor. He asked the military judge to take judicial notice of the
right.
fact that there was an acquittal. That was denied. The military judge allowed cross-examination questions, and really the way it played out in court was the defense counsel got to ask one question of Lance Corporal B on cross-examination about the prior acquittal. That's it. That was the only evidence that the members had of this prior acquittal. And that's the problem with allowing these trials within a trial under 413 to come in, that the defense has to basically defend on all fronts now, and while it's still trying to defend against the allegations of the assault against Lance Corporal K.
You focused on issue one. Is that the issue you wish to stand on, or do you think there's merit to issue two?
No, Your Honor, there's certainly merit to issue two. And
how do the two issues relate?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How do the two issues relate?
Well, certainly in terms of the prejudice of issue two, the fact that the government's case is really bolstered by this 413 evidence relates there. But given the fact that the trial counsel's comments, the improper comments in closing...
What are the three... There's, depending on who's counting and how they're counting, there's, in your view, anywhere from up to 20 or 19 improper comments. Which are the three, if you had to pick, that you'd focus our attention on, and why?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, certainly the most egregious one would be where the trial counsel, in his closing statement, says that the defense counsel hinted at calling Lance Corporal B and Lance Corporal R liars. But if he didn't stand up there in closing and call them liars to their face, and conceivably they were in the courtroom at the time because he mentioned it, if he didn't do that, then in essence PFC Solomon was guilty of the offenses against Lance Corporal B and R. So he's actually arguing that he's guilty of the prior court-martial where he was acquitted. So that would be the most egregious. But also, these facts are very similar to the case in Fletcher, where in Fletcher, this court had said that the trial counsel saying that the appellant's defense...
I'm sorry, just finish your list, please, so I can pocket it and then argue why it's Fletcher or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's example number one. What's example two and
would
three?
Would be the absolutely ridiculous comment, Your Honor. And example three would be the JFK assassination, saying that this was similar to the JFK assassination and claiming that distinguishing PFC Solomon from President Kennedy in the Bay of Pigs and going to the grassy knoll and all those issues.
Well, so why, if the defense theory of the case was that this was a gigantic conspiracy, right, that somehow there was a gigantic government conspiracy to bring up charges and evidence against this PFC or Lance Corporal, who appeared to be just an average PFC or Lance Corporal, with no evidence. I mean, if that was just the argument that the defense is making, why isn't that a fair tack for the trial counsel to take, to say that's ridiculous? Why would there be a conspiracy against a PFC?
Your Honor, certainly there's an appropriate way to argue that for the United States, and the appropriate way would not be to say that PFC Solomon has more conspiracy theories than the JFK assassination. And to go into detail about that assassination, which is similar to...
Well, what law do you have that makes that an improper argument as a matter of law? I mean, just because you don't like it, that's not the test, is it?
Well, Your Honor, this court in Fletcher said that drawing out public figures like Jesse Jackson and people of that nature in that case was inappropriate to do on the trial counsel's part, and this is similar to that type of conduct. And certainly the burden shifting that basically occurred when the trial counsel argued that the defense had to get up and call Lance Corporal B and Lance Corporal R liars to their face, the United States is at that point basically saying, members, the defense has to call these two liars, and if they don't, then they're guilty of that offense, which means they're guilty of this offense as well. And when we look at the prejudice here for the second issue, all three Fletcher factors favor the appellant. The government concedes the second one right off the bat, that the curative instruction was inappropriate and was because it was the generic limiting instruction this court in Fletcher said is inadequate. Next, the severity of the misconduct. The severity the misconduct was not confined to just the closing argument or the rebuttal argument. It was both the closing and the rebuttal argument. There was also many instances of misconduct in this case. As Judge Ryan mentioned, I believe it was depending on how you're looking at it, with about 22 transcribed pages of closing and rebuttal, I calculated to be about a couple dozen instances of misconduct. Also, the length of trial and deliberations, this factor also weighs in favor of PFC Solomon because the trial took 4 days and the members took 2.5 hours to deliberate. Where in Fletcher, that case, that trial lasted 3 days, deliberations took 4 hours, and this court found that factor in favor of the appellant there as well. And the weight of this evidence is not strong. At the base of it, we have a he said case where the government is bringing in witnesses to comment on the demeanor of the complaining witness after he made the complaint. But and as well as no forensic evidence of any evidentiary value in terms of any pictures that may or may not have been taken on a cell phone. And the way this ties in, as Chief Judge Baker, you asked, is this 413 evidence also bolstered this government's case. So the two are linked in that way. So this court cannot be confident that PFC Solomon was convicted on the basis of this evidence alone.
Is this a fair statement, counsel? If we agree with you on the first issue, we don't need to reach the second issue. So that's my first question.
Yes, Your Honor.
And my second question is, if we don't agree with you on the first issue, do you agree that that weakens your argument on the second issue?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would not say it would stop.
That's why I used weakened, not destroyed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thanks.
If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Major David Roberts, and along with Colonel Stephen Newman, I represent the government in this matter. This court should affirm the decision of the court below for two reasons. First,
counsel, could you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Can you hear in the back? Okay, thank you.
Is this on? All right. This court should affirm the decision of the court below for two reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting the 413 evidence because he properly applied the law and the evidence supported his findings of fact. And second, appellant fails to demonstrate that trial counsel's argument was plain or obvious error.
Being held by the MPs at a date certain and a time certain is pretty good alibi defense. Is it not?
No, Your Honor.
It's not a good alibi to say, I have this written document saying I was in detention with the MPs at that time?
No, Your Honor, not in this case. It's not a complete alibi.
I'm asking you the abstract question first.
Oh, yeah.
Would it not be a good alibi to say I was in police detention?
Oh, yes. Yes, it would, Your Honor.
Pretty good alibi, isn't it, depending on why you're in detention? But
yes, and that is reliable evidence.
Okay,
that
and I would not be surprised to say you think that the statements from the Lance Corporals otherwise override that alibi?
Yes, Your Honor.
But my question for you is, was this contradiction in the record before the military judge addressed in his findings and conclusions of law?
The contradiction was not expressly addressed by the military judge. The military judge was able to reconcile the contradiction between the extremely credible evidence given by the two Lance Corporals.
Where does he reconcile it in his findings?
The reconciliation is implicit in his conclusion that that the assaults did occur, Your Honor.
Well, that, I mean, implicit, is that an implicit finding? What is it? I don't know what it is.
There's no finding of fact, Your Honor.
There's no finding of fact on resolving this.
That's right,
Your Honor. Leaving aside for the moment whether it was error or not to grant judicial notice of this thing, but you got a pretty substantial amount of stuff out here, and then you've got the testimony of the two complaining witnesses. Isn't it incumbent on the judge to, before admitting the 413 testimony, to resolve this and put his conclusions in writing?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what
he didn't do it, did he?
There's no express resolution in the findings of fact and the conclusions of law, Your Honor.
Okay. Counsel, in a case such as this, as a general matter, evidence of an uncharged crime is not admissible, with certain exceptions, and evidence of a crime for which a person has been acquitted is generally not admissible. The rule 413 makes an exception for that, for these sexual offenses, and provides that they're admissible if relevant. And the relevance is one of the key tests. One of the key tests then within that is a determination by the judge that the event actually happened. And what my colleague's questions seem to be getting at is the issue of whether these uncharged acts happen. This being a key aspect of the government's case in getting in the 413 evidence, and a key aspect before the judge, and with the alibi evidence before the judge, what are we to make of the fact that the judge declined, for whatever reason, to address that alibi expressly in the findings that the judge issued? That would seem to be a major omission in this case, casting doubt upon the value of the judge's findings.
Yes, Your Honor. The Huddleston determination here, as adopted by this court, right, was not clearly unreasonable because there was not a complete alibi. I mean, this would be a different case if appellant had been out of town that night or had been in police custody even from the time that the two victims testify that they went to sleep, for example.
I understand the argument you're making, but isn't that, in terms of the levels of responsibility for making that determination, a determination that needs to be made by the military judge who was present at the trial, observing all the evidence and the witnesses and the documents? Isn't it incumbent upon the judge to make that reconciliation as opposed to relying on appellate courts to divine something from the record?
No, sir. I'm not aware of any authority that would make that arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable. And it is within the military judge's discretion to reconcile potentially contradictory forms of evidence that are adduced on motion.
I understand that. Where would you point to in the judge's findings where the judge reconciled the alibi with the other evidence in the case?
There's nothing in the appellate exhibit, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, where in the judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law is the alibi mentioned even?
It's not, Your Honor.
And that doesn't seem problematic to you?
It does not, Your Honor, because the...
But I mean, basically, this is what we have to look at. Why, looking at this document, should we assume that he considered it at all? It's not even mentioned.
Because the evidence was submitted on motion, the record clearly indicates that the defense counsel argued it on his motion. In fact, it was the cornerstone of the defense motion in response. Actually, the defense motion in limine here.
Counsel, that brings another issue up. When we look at the judge's findings and conclusions on Joint Appendix 97, where he's analyzing the strength of proof of the prior act, he states, the evidence of the prior act was given under oath at an Article 32 and at a previous general court-martial, and then he finds that testimony compelling. Did he have access, was the record from the Article 32 and the previous general court-martial in evidence before this 39A hearing?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. In candor, I believe it was appended to the defense motion, though. But I can file a supplemental brief on that.
So you think that the transcript of the Article 32 and the transcript of the prior trial were appended?
Not the transcript of the prior trial, no, Your Honor.
Well, my question is that neither of those documents are in the record. There is no indication that they were appended to the record. Why do we have the judge saying that essentially he looked at them in finding the testimony compelling?
I don't have an explanation for that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Can I turn you to the Griggs acquittal line of questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
Putting aside what due sensitivity means in the context of acquittal, which is an interesting judicial term, was the military judge showing due sensitivity in the context of his findings and conclusions of law with respect to the prior acquittal? And in addressing that question, what should we make of the fact that it was the government that urged the military judge to instruct on the acquittal and said that that was necessary to remove undue prejudice?
Assuming arguendo that the Griggs requirement, as you describe it, Your Honor, applies in the 413 context, due sensitivity was shown here.
And let's not worry about Griggs, just say my question is, was there appropriate consideration given to the acquittal in the military judge's findings, especially in light of the government's request that the judge instruct on the acquittal?
Yes, Your Honor. There was, Your Honor. Here, the military judge allowed the defense counsel to ask questions about the fact of the acquittal, the fact that he was acquitted at court-martial is different from the underlying facts of the charges at the previous court-martial.
Why wasn't it error not to take judicial notice of this?
Because there's no requirement.
It's a matter of public record. It's exactly the kind of thing that one normally takes judicial notice of.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's a matter of public record. It's precisely the kind of thing that one normally takes judicial notice of.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for you on that question.
Can I ask you, have you read the entire record of trial in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you had to give me a rough estimate, how much of the government's time during the trial, during its presentation of evidence, and during its opening and during its closing was spent on the 413 incidents as opposed to the offense with which the appellant was charged?
I would estimate approximately 25% of the government's time pertained to the previous incidents, Your Honor.
And so do you think when the military judge said that he didn't think that there was much likelihood that this prior incident would distract the fact finder, do you think that when 25% of the case is spent on a prior incident, that's a true statement?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is a fair assessment. The government spent as much time as was necessary to establish that the previous acts occurred and so that the members could make that determination. I don't think that...
You don't think that a stranger to the to the case that just looked at the closing argument wouldn't think that he was being charged and convicted of both incidents?
No, Your Honor, especially
not... You don't think reading that closing that that's what you would come away believing?
No, Your Honor, and especially when this court looks to the judge's instruction, I believe that's on JA 68, there's a long curative instruction that was given during the trial counsel's closing argument about how the evidence of the previous incidents could be used.
Counsel, the two lance corporals were obviously witnesses as to the prior incidents. They were witnesses that were supporting the government's case, not pivotal to the government's case. Don't you think it's a little unusual that the government led off with those two witnesses and spent almost 45 minutes questioning them, which is more time than they spent questioning the alleged victim of the charge?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's unusual because, again, it was a pertinent fact that the government needed to establish here on this record before this court that the prior incidents did, in fact, take place in order to use those incidents under 413 for propensity.
Absent the 413 propensity evidence, how strong was the government's case without if none of that evidence had come in?
It was strong.
I think we would agree, we'll take away 25% of the government's case, right? Because you said that they spent 25% of their time on it.
It would have been a completely different case, Your Honor, and it nevertheless would have been strong, even though it would have been circumstantial. As appellant points out, there's no forensic evidence, there's no DNA evidence here. However, there was the word given under oath by a Marine, and that Marine's testimony, his credibility, was not called into question. It was not impeached. There was no reputation evidence or character for untruthfulness evidence.
Is evidence of a sexual assault on females probative with regard to evidence of a sexual assault, a charge of a sexual assault on a male?
Yes, Your Honor. We're all service members.
Say again?
Yes, Your Honor. It is.
How so?
Is
there any authority for that proposition?
I don't have a
precise authority. Is that what the expert testimony was offered for during the pretrial motions?
On pretrial motion, yes. There was expert testimony that ran toward the paraphilia of committing sexual assaults at night upon sleeping persons under the cover of darkness. And that's the propensity that it was offered for in this case. At least in this case, the differing genders of the victims is not relevant.
So, I mean, that evidence was offered to show that the difference in genders between the victims in the first incident and the alleged victim in the second incident, or the alleged victims in both, it didn't matter what sex they were, right?
Right. Yes, Your Honor. So, in summary, on issue one, the military judge's findings, fact, conclusions of law were not arbitrary, were not fanciful, were not clearly unreasonable. It's certainly, as the dissent in the court below showed, there can be differences of opinion on whether the alibi evidence or the acquittal evidence there can be differences of opinion on that. However,
you don't disagree that the alibi evidence is a weighty factor for the military judge to have considered in making the determination as to whether to admit the propensity evidence under 413?
It is a relevant factor, yes, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, without that factor, all you would have would be the two statements of the women, right? And so there'd be nothing to balance it against.
It would require, yes, Your Honor, it would require the military judge to reconcile, which he did in his conclusions of law.
And again, the government's position as to the complete failure to even mention that alibi evidence in his findings of fact and conclusions of law is that it's okay?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean,
we should just assume that because it was presented to him during the actual motions hearing, that we should assume, even though it's not in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, that he did in fact consider it?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court is inclined to give less deference because that's not in writing, this court can certainly do so under Berry. However, the standard of review is still abuse of discretion, and it still applies the rule in Travers that this court would have to find that it was arbitrary or fanciful, clearly erroneous, and appellant has not made that showing here.
If we find either that it was error for the judge to do what he did with regard to one, or that the trial counsel's argument was error, what's your best argument on prejudice?
On issue one, we have no good argument on prejudice.
Okay, sure. You basically concede that if he erred, there's prejudice.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
what about two?
On two, this court would apply the standard in Fletcher, but there would be no prejudice under issue two because the severity of the misconduct here was low and the relative weight of evidence was strong. However, before getting to the prejudice, I just want to make a quick point about plain and obvious error. There is no plain or obvious error in the trial counsel's argument because, again, let's look at the instances here.
Let's take a step back. First of all, was there error? And then address right. whether it was plain or obvious.
Yes, Your Honor, and there is an argument to be made that there is no error here. There's no vouching. If you look at the instances that appellant has identified, essentially the trial counsel is saying that the witnesses were believable as they testified in court. Now this court addressed that matter in Turlap. And they said, and this court said that a trial counsel saying that he came up here, she came up here and testified truthfully was not error.
That's vouching. What about calling the, you didn't call the witnesses liars? That's proper argument or improper argument?
That's not vouching, Your Honor, and that's not improper argument because it's not an unsolicited opinion on the guilt or the evidence.
Well, the issue is not just one of vouching, but whether the argument is proper or not. Why is that proper in the context of this case?
Yes, right. Because an important consideration there is that the defense case, not just the defense theory, but the entire defense case rested on the proposition that three independent witnesses were independently either mistaken or lying and trying to and that the government was trying to set up the client. And that's...
So you would argue fair response there. What about with respect to arguing recidivism rates that were not in the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a proper argument to say you should convict this guy and lock him up because of recidivism rates? I can't even say it.
No, that's not proper argument. That was
so
proper.
You would concede that that's improper argument?
Yes, but the analysis on that question, that particular question, is different because
they objected.
They objected, and there was a long curative instruction.
And did the curative instruction address recidivism?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
So how was that curative instruction curative if it didn't address the error?
Because it addressed the proper purpose for that type of evidence, Your Honor, and for propensity evidence.
And was it proper or improper argument to argue that the person was going out the gate rather than in the gate in light of the MP report?
Yes, Your Honor, that's reasonable inference.
I gave you two choices, so you can't say yes.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I see my time is about to expire. May I briefly?
As always, you're allowed to answer my question over time.
Yes,
Your Honor. Anybody else's.
It was appropriate for the trial counsel to argue that that the accused was going out of the gate or in the gate at the time.
Why? What was in the record that allowed fair inference for him to argue that fact?
There was the testimony of Lance Corporal B and Lance Corporal R that the appellant was in their room and touching them at some point during that night.
So it was fair to the argument then is it's fair to infer that he was exiting the base, notwithstanding the MP report saying he was entering the base.
It was fair argument that he left the argument at issue.
Oh, he left and came back.
He could have left and come back.
And that's why it's fair argument. Did you get your question answered, by the way?
Yeah.
Any other question?
Hopefully, it's quick. On page 97 of the joint appendix, it appears that the military judge there is making the 403 balancing test, weighing the prejudicial effect against the probative value. Item A says, strength of proof of prior act, conviction versus gossip. What does the word conviction refer to there in the military judge's analysis?
I believe there he's merely applying the test from, it was actually the test pre-Berry from Wright that cited Guardia, Your Honor.
I understand that, but what conviction is the military judge talking about in this case?
There's no conviction of the prior act. I think I can't speak in the record of silent as to what he was applying there. I believe he's merely stating the standard from Guardia, Your Honor.
Because we have acquittals in this case, is that not the factual matter?
Yes, there was an acquittal in the case. There was, I mean, this is not pertinent to the 413 issue, but there was a summary court martial conviction.
Right.
One more question, counsel. Judge.
Counsel, you indicated that the government's response as to the conspiracy was a fair response. Can you point us to where in the defense arguments, either on opening and closing, that they utilized a conspiracy theory? Was that term ever used?
It was not, Your Honor, no.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the appellant, on rebuttal.
Chief Judge Baker, if there are no further questions, I relinquish my time to the court.
Can you speak up?
Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I'll relinquish my time to the court.
Are there any further questions from the bench? Okay, thank you very much, counsel. We thank both counsel. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court. However, we will stay in place and do a brief question and answer period following the adjournment.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.